The White Network presents The Heretic's Hour with Carolyn Yeager.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to The Heretic's Hour tonight on November 4th, 2013. Yes, we have discarded daylight savings time in the United States. We're into the dark months now, and I can tell you it's really dark here. It's been a dark day all day today, cloudy and gray, and it's got dark so early. It's something different to get used to, although truthfully, and I always say I wish we didn't change our time. We just kept the same time all year long. But we've got December coming up, which is brightens and cheers the month by the Christmas season. And bringing light into the darkness is what we're all about. I'm speaking of revisionism, of course, both historical and holocaustic, and they do overlap. In this program, I will finish my coverage of the newest revisionist book by Carlo Mattonio, Thomas Cues, and Jürgen Graf, titled The Extermination Camps of Action Reinhardt. This is part six, and all of the prior episodes except one have been on The Heretic's Hour. So part two was the only one that I did on my Saturday show. I kind of wish I had them all in the same place, but then I didn't want to wait a week before doing each one at that time either. First, I want you to consider why this is important to be talking about this, to be writing about it for these revisionists to be doing this work. That is, all the efforts, you know, that they go to correct the very wrong historical record of the Second World War and preceding and following that tragic event, and why it is so difficult, too. It takes the smartest people we have to become true Holocaust revisionists, and we can see that they are. When you grasp all the data that has to be reviewed, digested, comprehended, remembered, and then question with facts, figures, and accuracy. It's a gigantic undertaking. Everyone who knows Germar Rudolph, for example, knows what a smart guy he is, a real brain. He earned a PhD in chemistry. Vincent Renoir was a chemical engineer and then became a teacher of mathematics. He has a fantastic mind, in my opinion. Robert Faurisson was a professor of literature at a prestigious French university. Jürgen Graf is also very brainy, speaks and writes in about 15, 16 languages, something like that, chose to be a teacher of high school age boys in a Swiss private school, teaching literature and language before being rudely dismissed because of writing a book questioning the Holocaust. Men like these see right through the fakery of Holocaust literature once they take a look at it. There are others, of course, who I didn't mention. But I'm going to mention two more. There are authors of the book we're talking about, and that is Carlo Mattonio, who's also super smart, a well-educated European, whose ability to deal with mounds of data and take from it what is fact versus what is disingenuous fallacy is really impressive. And when you read Carlo's books, and they are numerous, you see the amount of detail he includes in the way of numbers, weights, measurements, charts, graphs, etc., which most of us have difficulty just following along with. But he still has passion, too, for his subject. He's a scientist and a passionate man both. And then finally, last but not least at all, Thomas Cues also exhibits a superior brain and an honorable character, thus seeking truth over worldly rewards, and doing yeoman labor in research and writing. He keeps his scientific objectivity like the others do. So I'm saying that Holocaust revisionism is the most difficult and challenging work of the truth movement, if I can call it that. And I really do believe that. It takes our best and brightest, and those who have been and are now involved in it are our best and brightest. And so now, on to why is it important? Well, for that, I'm going to briefly discuss a sinister article I came across from October 31st in the Montreal Gazette. It tells us that the U.S. ambassador to the U.N., Samantha Power, announced Thursday that the United Nations has agreed to give the U.S. Holocaust Museum, that's that USHMM, the Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington, D.C., a full copy of the archive documenting thousands of cases against accused World War II criminals in Europe and Asia. Accused criminals, not those who have been necessarily found guilty of being criminals. And I knew she was the, I knew she'd been in the news for, you know, when she became U.S. ambassador to the U.N. And she was a, an advisor of some kind for Obama previous to that. She's been in the Obama administration. She's a Irish American, but she's married to a full Jew, Cass Sunstein. I didn't know if she was married to Cass Sunstein. Or if I did, I'd forgotten. And she graduated from both Yale and Harvard. You know, she's one of those. She's one of those global elitists. She sold on the Obama administration and his policies, as is her husband. Anyway, she's our ambassador to the UN. And there was, she told the Anti-Defamation League's National Commission Centennial Meeting on last Thursday. Now, this was, this is the centennial year, the 100th anniversary of the creation of the Anti-Defamation League. And it was in 1913, and so this is 2013. And so they're having all kinds of activities and meetings and things over this year, and this was one of them. And she announced then that the archive of the United Nations War Crimes Commission will benefit scholars, quote, at a time when Holocaust denial is embraced by many who prefer diversionary fantasies to inconvenient facts. It's actually the other way around. Which are the diversionary fantasies and which are the inconvenient facts? But this is the way they talk. And the article tells us that the commission, this national commission, no, not the ADL commission, the United Nations War Crimes Commission was established in October 1943 by 17 allied nations. You know, it was really established by 3 or 4 allied nations, but they include all the others who signed on to it, to issue lists of alleged war criminals, ultimately involving about 37,000 individuals, and examine the charges against them and try to assure their arrest and trial. This commission, War Crimes Commission, was shut down in 1948. Well, you know, they had everything was completed by then. They had their Nuremberg trials. They had taken over Germany. They, you know, they had everything in place, and they didn't need to do that anymore. They probably, and of course, you know, they had 37,000 individuals, most of whom there would be no case against them, but the prosecutors drew up some kind of charges, and then they would see if they could, you know, make a case out of it and make it stick. Anyway, now British academic Dan Plesch has led the campaign for greater access to this archive, which the UN has been holding. And he expressed delight that representations to the U.S. government and the Holocaust Museum, which is a federal agency, it says this here, the Holocaust Museum is a federal agency of the U.S. government, as well as recent support from leading international legal figures, including Justice Richard Goldstone, who so many people wanted to commend because he made one good decision about Israel, but he still, you know, doesn't make him, he's still a Jew doing the Jews' business. So Richard Goldstone also thought this was a good idea and supported this. That this will finally make this archive available as the commission intended in 1948. Flesch explained that the files contain details of many charges of crimes that are not being prosecuted extensively today. Well, of course they're not being prosecuted. These are people who just got on the list, you know, who happen to be probably connected with National Socialism or something. Maybe not even that. Got on this list of being possible war criminals. And they've been left alone now. They want to check over these people again. Some more and see if they can conjure up some kind of case against these people. They have to be pretty old, you know, but this just shows how evil these people are and this whole scheme is. This whole Holocaust scheme, it's not going to go away. They want to make it bigger and bigger and pull in more and more and get more power, more control, and get rid of people like you and I in the process and shut us up for good. So that's why it's important to keep going with this. And so I'm going to go directly to, I have a good little item here from Wilfred Hank that he posted at the Revlog. I'll go into that a little bit more if I have time later in the show about Dr. Sturdy Coles, because I skipped over, of course they wrote about, Q's did a whole chapter on Sturdy Coles, that woman who's started investigating at Treblinka and is supposed to be some kind of an archaeologist, I don't know. It's just a big farce, but I didn't get into that chapter in these programs, and if I have time, I'm going to read just two paragraphs that Wilfred Hank wrote that I thought were pretty good, but they don't fit right at the moment. They fit later on. So I'm going to go now to chapter 10 in the book and work my way to the end. I just have a little bit from each chapter that are left, chapters 10 through 13. So this one is Thomas Q's response to the chapter on testimonies on the Action Reinhardt camps. And it's chapter 10-1 on page 1144. And he's responding to Jason Myers, one of the five bloggers who wrote their report criticizing our three revisionists on Action Reinhardt, what they wrote on Action Reinhardt camps previous to this book. And he says to Jason Myers, but do the problems with, for example, Huss's statement really amount to minor anomalies, which in the end only help to show their consistency with authenticity and truth? Quote, that's in quotes. Well, that's what Jason Myers said, that Rudolf Huss, I should say, Rudolf Huss, who was the commandant of Auschwitz, made a lot of contradictions in his statements, and Myers is calling them minor anomalies, which our revisionists try to make into a great big deal when they're just little meaningless things, and they try to make them mean a lot. And he's responding to that, and he said, in the 2008 article referred to, I compared six accounts, this is Q's, left by Huss with regard to his alleged visit to the Treblinka extermination camp. These accounts all date from the period 1946 to 1947, only a few years after the alleged event. So he is calling this a visit by Huss to Treblinka, where he, you know, took part in a gassing, or he ordered it, or he did something, which I don't recall at the moment, but he's referring to that as an alleged visit, so it's in their mind it's not proven that that actually took place. Q says, as I demonstrate, Huss manages to contradict himself and the official version of events, and also documented historical facts on several crucial points. Here a brief summary will suffice, and then he summarizes it. And the point being is that Huss is a crucial witness to the extermination at Treblinka, that there was such a process going on, because he's, you know, said so in the stuff that he was saying to the court and so on in his testimony that he wrote down in his confession. But his testimony is actually worthless. Well, that's my word. That's not Q's word. As is Adolf Eichmann's testimony, they both were abducted and brutalized and then, you know, eventually put on, asked to write out their confessions and then put on the witness stands and so on. And they were by then, you know, they were saying what they had been told to say or that they had decided they should say, to make things go better for themselves and so on. But that's just one little, I didn't go into anything more in that part of chapter 10. Then we have chapter 10.2.2, page 1147, under false confessions. And Q's writes, it must first be pointed out here that it is misleading to claim that many or most of the Nazi perpetrators and auxiliaries admitted to, quote, extremely violent crimes, unquote, as in virtually every case the defendant admitted only to complicity in murder. Very rarely do we find alleged perpetrators confess, these perpetrators in particular he's talking about, confess to committing atrocities on their own initiative, or even to direct involvement in killings. When the latter, which means the complicity, in the case of complicity, within the context of the Reinhardt camps, it frequently concerns the killing of sick or infirm deportees and inmates. That is, when they have admitted to being complicit in killings, it frequently concerns sick or infirm inmates who they thought would be better off because they were not able to keep up and they were suffering and so on. Anyway, he then goes on to say, in addition to probable or confirmed cases of torture, such as Rudolf Huss, many confessed after being promised mercy. That is, it was implicitly understood that they could get away with lenient sentences if they corroborated the official version of events before the court, or they were threatened with death. That is, threatened with life in prison or possibly even extradition to countries where they could face a death sentence. And so, for these reasons, they confessed things that they knew weren't true, but because that was the only option they had to make it better for themselves. As has already been pointed out, Hughes writes, the majority of the defendants who stood trial for involvement in alleged gas chamber mass murders did indeed receive sentences that were astonishingly lenient in view of the number of murders to which they were found complicit. And frequently they were released after a few years, or they were even given a sentence of a few years. Sometimes they were given longer sentences and then released much earlier. Because the court knew that these things weren't true and that they had cooperated. They had, because the court wanted to, you know, find all these things is actually happening for the record, for the historical record and so on. And therefore, they didn't really seriously punish these German SS people or, you know, various camp guards and so on who did go along with them and tell these lies. So then in chapter 10.2.4, page 1157, it's about the first gas chamber building at Sobibor. There's been a lot of, there's controversy about all of it, but there's a lot of controversy about this, that there was such a thing as the first gas chamber building. Of course, there are no gas chamber buildings at Sobibor, but this is the stories. There's this big story about the first one. And Q's writes, now I'm taking this out from this chapter, you know. I just start somewhere where it can, you know, give an idea of what's being discussed in it. As for my argument, he writes, concerning the structure and building materials of, quote, the first gas chamber building, unquote, the main point of which is that the main witnesses could not decide upon whether it was made of wood or bricks and concrete, which he finds pretty astonishing. And he says, Myers shrugging this off is simply so blatantly dishonest that I can only admonish him to go back to elementary school. He continues, the importance of this glaring discrepancy is clear from the fact that Shelvis, and Shelvis is that Holocaust historian, a kind of a newer breed, not that the new breed is better than the old breed at all, but he's one of the, I don't know where he's from. He's not, he doesn't go way back, but they have some respect for him. Matonio has written about him, not so much respectfully, but that he's more objective and more fair-minded to what looking for what actually took place, you know, what could be corroborated rather than just a big liar like so many of them. So this is who this Shelvis is. Shelvis completely changed his mind on the truthfulness of Eric Bauer's statement on the matter between two editions of his, on this matter, between two editions of his monograph on the camp without ever giving a reason for this turnaround. Where he's saying that this Shelvis, once he learned about, these witnesses, they couldn't, you know, they were, some said the first gas chamber building was made of wood, some said it was made of bricks and concrete. After this, he changed his mind about Eric Bauer's truthfulness. Eric Bauer is a major witness. He was an SS person, or at least a camp guard. I think they were supposed to be SS too, but he is a major witness who did said a lot of things that weren't true, but he changed his mind about this. And so Q says, as for the details on the victim group, quote unquote, of the alleged first trial gassings, quote unquote, Franz Stangl claimed that the victims consisted of 25 labor Jews. Franz Stangl is another German who confessed to a bunch of stuff, who had been there in those camps. You know, not as an inmate, as a guard of some kind or an administrator. He confessed to that at this first trial gassing in the first gas chamber, that there was 25 labor Jews who were gassed in there. And this means they were all males because, you know, these were Jews who worked on constructing the camp. And they kept their clothes on. They were gassed while they still were wearing their clothing. While Eric Fuchs and Heinrich Barbel, two other witnesses, spoke of female victims in this first gassing, numbering 30 to 40, according to Fuchs, who had to undress before they entered the gas chamber building. And Barbel even dumbfoundingly maintained that the victims were brought to the camp in a bus accompanied by Red Cross nurses. To add to the already striking discrepancy, Stangl testified that Christian Wirth, another German administrator, had overseen the trial gassing while behaving like a lunatic, while Fuchs lists the number of SS men as being present at the event, but does not mention Wirth being there, despite the behavior ascribed to him by Stangl, and despite the fact that SS Sturmbannführer Christian Wirth was the responsible inspector of the Reinhardt camp. So that's just more examples of these false witnesses, of how they don't agree with one another in most anything that they're saying. Now, we go to chapter 10.2.5 on page 1158, and this is about this Eric Bauer that I mentioned just a moment ago, and he is the one who's called the Gasmeister of Sobibor, meaning, you know, the gas master. He was in charge of doing the gassing. Hughes writes, Meyer's argument is more than a little disingenuous. If Bauer, as per his own admission of 15 November 1965, he was still in these 1965 trials testifying, this Bauer. If he had functioned as the Gasmeister in Camp 3 for at least the camp's first phase, operating the gassing engine and regulating the gas flow, he must have known not only the time required for the extermination procedure, but also at least approximately the approximate average number of deportees per transport, how many chambers there were, and how densely packed they were, as these factors would have had immediate bearing on his work. As seen above, Bauer also claimed that he had been involved in fitting the doors and fixtures in the second gas chamber building so that he would have had an excellent opportunity to compare the total gas chamber size of the old and new building. Moreover, Bauer was aware of gaps in the transport schedule. That's a quote, aware of gaps in the transport schedule. The lull in arriving transports caused by the supposed rebuilding of the, quote, gas chambers, unquote, and of the, quote, the variance of transport figures to the camp, unquote. The fact that Bauer provided widely divergent victim figures ranging from 30,000 to 350,000, while contradicting himself on the issue of the number and sizes of transports vis-a-vis the total victim figure, only serves to demonstrate that he was making things up as it suited him, and that these fabrications had only the most tenuous relation to actual reality. Most likely, Cuse writes, the 350,000 victim figure was something Bauer made up in order to ingratiate himself with the prosecutors in the Sobibor case, then under preparation, perhaps in the vain hope of having his own case retried. As for Bauer's description of how the gassing engine was rigged up and connected to the gas chambers, I refer to Carlo Mutonio's discussion of this issue in Chapter 8.50. Well, I never talked about that, but he's obviously... Carlo Mutonio is obviously going over that and showing how what Bauer's described as how these gassing engines worked was not workable. In fact, I think I kind of remember reading some of that now. I don't know if I read it on the air. So now I'm going to move to, excuse me for just 1 minute. Now I'm going to move to chapter 10.2.6, page 1163. Talking about Hubert Gomersky, or Hubert Gomersky, another one of the Germans, or, you know, people who were working there, not the inmates. Gomersky also claimed that the first gassings took place much later than in May 1942, as claimed by the court verdicts. So the court came up with the verdict that the first gassing took place in May 1942. But this Gomersky is one who says that it took place later than that. That's not correct. When interrogated in 1949, he mentioned offhandedly that, quote, the gassings were carried out only at a very late stage, unquote, a statement which begs the question, what went on in the camp before that? When testifying in 1965, first he was interrogated in 1949, then he was testified at this trial in Hagen in 1965, he claimed that he had arrived in Sobibor at the beginning of May 1942 and stated further, the gassings began after the work on the first pit had been completed, perhaps 2 to 3 months after my arrival. It cannot be correct that Jews were killed already before that, unquote. Later on, during the same court session, Gomersky claimed that the first transport had arrived for gassing 2 to 2.5 months after his own arrival in the camp. So, okay. The first transport of Jews, I guess, who were supposed to be gassed was 2 to 2.5 months after he himself arrived. Thus, according to Gomersky, the gassings did not commence until July or August 1942. But in 1964, he dated the arrival of the first transport to about a month after his own arrival. So he shifted himself to make it a little bit earlier. Even more revealing are Gomersky's statements on the mass graves in Camp 3. You know, I think this Camp 3 that they talk about all the time, really, there really wasn't a Camp 3. I'm not sure, but Because I'm not at all expert on all three of these camps. I think we're talking now about Sobibor. Yes, we are. But anyway, I wonder if these, I don't know if these things even exist, but they talk about them. The Holocaust, the you know, archaeologists and so on who study these camps, they say there's a camp one, a camp two, a camp three, and this is what was there and so on. Anyway, in 1964, Gomersky left the following description of how the grave pits, in camp three were excavated. He said, among the first tasks carried out following the arrival of Stangl's group was the excavation of pits in Camp 3. They were in total three large corpse pits. I estimate the length of the pits to approximately 30 to 40 meters, the width to 8 to 10 meters, and the depth to some 2 to 3 meters. The dimensions may have been different in individual cases. I can no longer say anything more specific on this. Well, you know, and I say, if these corpse pits actually existed then, why can't they be found now? Which they can't be. They think they have these things. They have these areas mapped out, you know. But they're not finding anything in them. Not finding what they need to find. There were, now going on with Gomersky, he continues, there were three corpse pits in Camp 3 located in order of their excavation. At the far end of the camp, as seen from the entrance to Camp 3, to the right by the fence behind the guard tower, and to the left by the fence diagonally behind the gas chamber. Of these three pits, the last mentioned was not used, since in the meantime an incineration facility had been installed in the area behind the guard tower. This consisted of a row of iron beams on top of which the corpses were placed. After that, a large fire was lit under this row of beams. In the following period of time, the recently killed Jews, as well as the corpses from the first mentioned pits, were burnt in this way. So they were gassing Jews at the time and then putting them in this incineration pit and on top of these iron beams, and they were also digging up corpses from pits of earlier killed and burning them there too. I cannot determine the point in time when this incineration facility was installed. I believe that it came about in connection with large Soviet breakthrough at the Eastern Front in 1943. That's what he says, 1943. During the time of a big breakthrough, when they got nervous, said, we better start burning all these bodies. So Q says Gomersky would thus have it that all the Jews killed in Sobibor during 1942 were interred in two pits of a total volume of 960 to 1200 cubic meters, with a hypothetical maximum of 8 corpses per cubic meter. This would correspond to a total of 7,680 to 9,600 corpses, as compared to the 101,370 Jews brought to Sobibor during 1942, according to the Hufla document. You see, they all go by the Hufla document. That's supposed to prove that all these Jews, which is a telegram, you know, intercepted telegram, but it agrees with this Corehair report, and that's what why they think it makes it so strong. There's a Corehair report about the number of Jews, you know, being sent where, here and there, where they were sent, and how many there were, and it adds up to this, to these numbers. And then there was this Hufla telegram with the same numbers. So since the numbers correspond, They say, well, that proves it. You know, that makes it that when two things correlate like that, well, then that's good confirmation. So, okay. So it says that there are this many Jews brought. And, our revisionist argument is that, they have brought those Jews there, but the Jews left and went on east. But because they don't have any record of them leaving, going on east, or they say that they didn't ever leave there. They went there and they died there, you know, so they must have been exterminated there, because we don't know what happened to them after that. So this is the big argument here, but the point they're making here is that these graves that they're pointing out that are the only ones there that are holding all these bodies or the ashes of the bodies are not big enough for this huge number of Jews. He's saying that there's room, if you're talking about corpses, to be burying them in the first place. In 1942, before they set up that extermination, that cremation pit, to burn them, they were burying them. And in 1942, 101,000 plus were brought to Sobibor, and they only had room in these burial graves for 7,000 to 9,000 or 9,500. So he says, even assuming, as we did in our Sobibor study, that cremations began in October 1942, give you that point, at a time when some 80,000 Jews had arrived, the implications of Gomersky's description fits very badly with the official version of events. Well, he's being kind of tongue-in-cheek there because, it doesn't fit at all. Again, if there was 80,000 Jews that had been gassed by then, they still only had room in these burial grounds for 7,000 to 9,500. So 7,500 to 9,500. So it's just totally, these are the things that absolutely make you, boggle your mind, that these Holocausters just keep pressing along with this stuff, even though their figures and their stuff doesn't add up at all. But they think, well, we're going to figure this out. We'll find out, we'll get some more information here. We're still searching. Well, Kues says then, testifying in Hagen, that Hagen trial in 1965, Gomersky gave different dimensions for the graves. And he goes into that quite a bit longer. This particular chapter goes on quite a ways, and he compares all kinds of grave dimensions and so on, which I'm not, going to go into. I'm stopping right there. And I'm going to move on to chapter 10-7 on page 1172, titled The Sobibor Prisoner Revolt, Himmler's 1943 Visit to Sobibor, and Witness Convergences. And Kues writes, more contradictory witnesses about Himmler's alleged visit. Okay, you see, this interests me a lot because, again, just like Rudolf Huss was supposed to have visited Treblinka and witnessed what was going on and saw the gassing facilities and so on, blah, blah, which he's actually lying about. There also is supposed to have been a visit from Himmler in 1943 to Sobibor, and I guess there was, although he calls it Himmler's alleged visit here. So I say, I guess that there's some question whether he actually did. But the Holocaust people have it down flat that he was there and so on. And so then they talk about this, how it went. Well, this is some interesting witness testimony of the people who were there in Sobibor at the time, supposedly, and what they said about this visit. Of course, they all saw him. There's very few witnesses to these camps because, as it said, everybody was exterminated. So there's nobody left, but there's a few. There was a few that was left, and these are some of these Jewish witnesses. The first one is Leon Feldhendler, who states that Himmler's visit took place in March 1943, and that the victims of the demonstration gassing were 200 women brought in from Lublin who had been, quote, locked up in a special barrack for 2 days, unquote. And then we have Zelda Metz. She's quite a character. She dates the visit to the late summer of 1943. The other guy was in March, or she says it's late summer, that the victims, 7,500 beautiful young girls, were brought in from the Jewish camp on Lipowa Street in Lublin. Then we have Thomas Blatt again, and he claims that the victims were over 300 specially selected young Jewish girls from the nearby city of Lodowa. And then whenever that was, probably right after the maybe early after the war. In 1949, though, the same Blatt stated that the victims were 80 Jews, gender unmentioned, who had arrived from Travniki. And then again in 1965, he said something different, that they were an unmentioned number of Jewesses from the same location. So he wasn't way off, but he wasn't really consistent either. Now, Moshe Bahir asserts that the victims numbering several hundred came from Travniki. And Abraham Cohn speaks of 500 Jewish girls from Travniki. They'd always like to say that it's girls, Jewish girls. And he is quoted as saying, as the execution was carried out, this is good, Himmler stood on the glass roof of the gas chamber and observed how the people were killed inside. He was a man with a dark face and an evil appearance. What a dark face. He has a very light complexion. But anyway, you know, the glass roof of the gas chamber, so he could look and watch. In a primitive place like Sobibor, I think this is it. A primitive place like Sobibor, they have a gas chamber with a glass roof. And then another one, Philip Bialowitz believed that, said that the girls had arrived from Majdanek and that they were to be experimented upon. He wasn't satisfied with the gassing them. He wanted to say they were experimented on for, I guess, Himmler to watch or something. And Itzhak Lichtman stated in 1945 that Himmler had arrived in an airplane in the summer of 1943 and that the victims came from various unnamed villages and small towns. And finally, the weirdest one of all, Ada Lichtman, she may be Itzhak Lichtman's wife, I don't know. Ada Lichtman, her account of the demonstration gassing, they call it that, is even more divergent, not to say bizarre and quasi-pornographic. Well, it was quasi-pornographic, and I didn't copy it onto this page because it's kind of long, but she's describing how Himmler came and all these young, beautiful Jewish girls were lined up in two rows in the barrack where they had been kept or something, and Himmler came and stood there and looked them all over from head to toe, and then he touched them, and then he walked with them to the gas chamber, and you know, then he oversaw or watched or whatever while they were being gassed. I mean, it's just really sick. These people come up with the sickest things. Hughes writes, Holocaust historians, despite the date of Himmler's visit being known, at least it's known to them, he called it an alleged visit, but they say they know when it was, and the references to various locations as to the origin of the hundreds of or thousands of beautiful Jewesses, you know, that is, they know when Himmler went to Sobibor, supposedly, and they know where these, we have all these different references to where the victims came from, you know, what places, what ghettos, what camps, and so on, were brought from to be in this demonstration gassing for Himmler. Yet, he says, they have not been able to locate any evidence for the transport of these alleged victims of the demonstration gassing, such as a note on a transfer of Jewish prisoners or even testimonies from other camps or ghettos. So there's zero evidence and zero documentation that this ever took place. But they've just got all these stories from these inmates about it. So, and then a little more on this, Hubert Gomersky, who we've already talked about, when confronted with the claim that a group of Jewish girls had been kept in the camp as part of the preparations for the Himmler visit, stated before the Hagen court, that was the one in the 65, that he said that is simply out of the question. He wouldn't go along with that. That was too far out for him. So now moving on to chapter 11, which I have very little from, but it is titled Real and Alleged Mass Graves and written by Carlo Mantegna, and it begins on page 1193. And 100 pages later, we find some conclusions, and that's what I'm going to read to you. That whole 100 pages, I went through that, and boy, it's really a lot of detail about mass graves, you know, and sizes and dimensions and all this stuff. More, you know, more than I had time for, and I didn't think it was anything I could pass on to you very well. But he does a total job there, 100 pages of it. And then he, on page 1293 to 1295, 2 pages, he writes a conclusion. And he says, if we accept this data for argument's sake and confront it with our estimated death toll at Sobibor, which is about 10,000. So the revisionists have estimated that the death toll, the actual deaths at Sobibor would be about 10,000 from various causes, not from gas chambers. Their burial would have required a volume of 5,000 to 10,000 cubic meters of mass graves. The grave mentioned by Muhlenkamp, now he was addressing Muhlenkamp's charges against him in this chapter 11. He says, the graves mentioned by him, if it were a real one, which, you know, he doesn't, the grave, not graves, the grave mentioned by Muhlenkamp, if it were a real one, and when subtracting a covering layer of 30 centimeters, that is 472 and a half square meters, would have had a volume of, let me give some figures, which would have accommodated, what's this important part, would have accommodated 12,694 corpses. Okay? That's how many you could have gotten into this grave that Muhlenkamp is making a bunch of noise about. And so, you know, since they think that the actual death toll at Sobibor, at least they're giving them that much, 10,000, they would have fit into this particular grave site if it was one, if it were a real one. But you know, he doesn't believe it's a real one. Mantegna doesn't. So then he continues. Dieter Pohl, that's one of the Holocaust historians, states that in the camps of the Reinhardt action, quote, a part of the victims, up to 5% of them, died already during the deportation trip due to the extreme conditions in the railway freight cars, unquote. And then he goes on about accepting that estimate. Well, you know, I know that Q's too has written about this, and some people got mad about it, and I didn't like it too much. But, you know, they're accepting that quite a lot of Jews died on the way to these camps because of harsh conditions in the traveling. I don't know if they were really packed into boxcars, but or not, but I don't, you know, they just give that. They're giving that because they don't want to argue about every little thing, and they want to, you know, be reasonable. And so they say 5%. But I don't know, that's not proven. See, and then people start saying, well, 5% died in the deportation. Well, nobody knows that. It's an estimate. And I don't know where the proof is of how extreme the conditions were on the way to the camps. But they, I'm not saying that they were comfortable. Anyway, Hughes goes on. If one accepts this estimate that 5%, you know, were already dead before by the time they got there, in Belzec, he's on Belzec now. No, this is not Hughes. This is this is Mantegna. Sorry. Then 21,750 persons would have died en route to Belzec, which is compatible even with the fictitious volume of the mass graves indicated by Kola. When Kola is that archaeologist, supposedly some type of Polish historian, archaeologist or something, who did the first surveys of these camps. At least he did Belzec in 2000, 2001. Sobibor was done then too, by him. He did these excavations, supposedly. Not really. He didn't really excavate anything. See, they don't want you to dig up these because of this Jewish law. So they managed to try to win that way by saying, well, we know that these Jews are buried in here, but we can't dig it up because this, you know, goes against our religious beliefs about the dead. So, but he's just saying that the number that could have died not from gassings would fit into these so-called grave sites if they think they're found. Then he says the second fundamental problem is that the number, shape, and dimensions of the mass graves identified by Kola, that's the same guy, he's probably the most important of the ones who've done the studies there, you know, and searched out the areas to find, decide where there were ruins and where there were buildings and so on and so forth. And he's the original one who did it. Of course, they did some way back when, in the 40s, but now in present time, he started this in 2000. And then others, as I talked about last week, I believe it was, they've had surveys starting in 2003 and going on all the way to 2011, maybe 12, and nobody's ever found anything that proves anything at all. In fact, it proves that there's nothing there is what it is, because they keep looking and they don't find it. So Latonya says that this shows that the real values of these figures are almost certainly far lower, making our hypothesis even more likely, like that they said, you know, 10,000 at Sobibor and, you know, numbers like that of those who actually died in these while they were at these camps. And here's where I could read that thing by Will Hank. But I'll finish what Matonio is saying. Matonio says it remains only to draw a conclusion from this chapter that Muhlenkamp's arguments are absurd, incoherent, stupid, hypocritical, and deceptive. And by posing them, he has shown all the desperation of a person trying to defend the indefensible. Quite contrary to his intentions, he has actually demonstrated excellently the total inconsistency of the Orthodox Holocaust thesis in relation to the mass graves of the Reinhardt camps. This is especially true for Belzec, which is the weak link in the chain of camps and the real thorn in the side of the Orthodox Holocaust historians. Well, I didn't know that Belzec was the weak link amongst those three camps. That's what he's telling us. Thanks to Muhlenkamp, we now know, I think his first name is Ricardo. He's a German who lives in South America, supposedly. Thanks to Muhlenkamp, we now know with an even higher certainty that the mass burial of the alleged victims in the mass graves at Belzec, as allegedly identified by Kola, would have been impossible. Therefore, the related mass gassings cannot be considered real. That's his final word there. And then I mentioned that phony dig by this Jaime that I talked about last week. And it came up in what I was reading. And then I linked to that article. I found that article on the web. And I linked to it in the program post. Haimi is this guy, how you spell this. He's an Israeli who is a kind of he's supposed to be an archaeologist. He digs around in the desert for things, you know, Jewish things. And then he decided that he had relatives who died in these camps. And so he went up there and he got support from somewhere, you know, financial support. And now he's making a big, big show of himself up there in, I think he's at Sobibor doing it. And he hasn't found anything either, but he talks about how he makes a big deal out of what he has found and acts like he's going to, you know, get to all of it eventually. And he just found a few utensils and stuff. So there's that. And then there's this Caroline Sturdy Coles, who showed up a couple years ago. And the media started making a big thing out of her and how she was in Treblinka doing her archaeological surveys. She's just a graduate student still, and she's still studying, or she might be she might have just gotten her PhD, and she's working under some professors or something. Anyway, you know, she's getting all the support because she's going along with the whole Holocaust story. And Wilf Hienk at the revisionist blog, and he posted this in last August, in August 2013. And I just looked at it today, and he has a good article there about it. But I'm going to read the last two paragraphs of it. And he says, this article by Dr. Sturdy Coles is nothing but an attempt to explain why a thorough investigation by experts in the field will not be done. The reasons given are, however, not convincing. Far from it. Germans are accused of having murdered between 5 and 6 million Jews, yet no investigation by experts in the field of crime investigations has ever been undertaken. And then he says, if revisionists are to go away, substantial evidence has to be produced, and that article makes it clear that her article, the article that he's talking about that she has written, a long one, which says nothing, that this will not be the case. Why not? The burial law, that law is applied selectively if it is suspected that bodies will be found, exceptions are made. This leaves only one possibility. The promoters of the Holocaust know that no graves will be found at Treblinka. For instance, graves large enough to have held the hundreds of thousands allegedly killed there and buried at first. Efforts are therefore made to hide behind laws like the burial law, and sadly, someone like Dr. Caroline Sturdy Coles is supportive of this. And so we're now going to our break. That was written by Wilfred Hienk. We're going to our break, ladies and gentlemen, and we'll be listening to the swing music, the German swing music by...
Thank you.
Isn't that nice? Well, welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, and we're now in the second hour of the Heretics Hour tonight, and I'm Carolyn Yeager, and my topic is the final ending of the, and the summing up of the book by Carlo Mantegna, Thomas Kues, and Jürgen Graf about the so-called extermination camps of the Reinhardt, what they call the Reinhardt camps, or the Action Reinhardt. And by the way, the book is now available to be purchased in two softcover volumes. And the price I saw was $100 for the two books. Well, it sounds like a lot of money, but it's if you're interested in these, in collecting these books and having them and being able to look into them, it's certainly not too much, because it's a huge opus here. And you can buy them at the Kodo Bookstore and also at the Barnes Review Bookstore and at Amazon. Amazon's still hanging in there for revisionist books, Holocaust denial books. So now I'm at chapter 12, and it's titled The Burning / Cremation of the Bodies. And it is by Carlo Mantegna again. And I'm on page 12, it starts on page 1296. And I am just taking a part from it here, and I'm reading as follows. That says, Mantegna writes, the eighth chapter of the Cut and Paste Manifesto is presented as follows. And he is quoting from the book by the paper, the online book by the five bloggers. He calls them the cut and paste. He calls it the cut and paste manifesto. He's really funny. He says the cut and paste manifesto writes chapter 8, also by Roberto. Oh, it's not Ricardo. He's Roberto Mühlenkamp, is dedicated to deconstructing MGK's farcical claims that cremating the murdered victims' bodies at the Nazi extermination camps. That's how they write. When these guys write, they constantly use the word Nazi and all kinds of other words that make it sound really bad. The Nazi extermination camps would have been an impracticable undertaking as concerns fuel requirements, cremation time, and disposal of cremation remains. There, he's talking like, it was not impractical at all to do all of this. Well, Carlo Mantegna writes, this verdict on our research merely reveals the plagiarist blogger's unparalleled ignorance and obtuse arrogance. In chapter 11, I demonstrated that Mühlenkamp's arguments concerning the mass graves of the Action Reinhardt camps are farcical, to say the least. And, you know, so Mühlenkamp is using that word back at them, calling their claims farcical. See, that's how they do. They're not even original. And going on with Carlo Mantegna, in the present chapter, I will show that the label farcical is even more apt for describing his arguments relating to cremation. In my studies on this issue, lasting more than two decades and culminating in the two-volume 1,211-page opus, which has an Italian title. It's about the crematories in Auschwitz, or the cremation facilities of Auschwitz. And it's never been translated out of Italian yet, I guess. But it's another huge book that he wrote. He says, this chapter by Mühlenkamp is certainly the most ludicrous among all the rubbish I have read about this issue. You know, he's comparing himself that all the two decades worth of work in this two-volume opus and all the work that he has done and, you know, all his knowledge, and he's comparing himself to this guy Mühlenkamp and what he knows. He says, as stupidity goes, it exceeds even the ravings in the paper titled On the Necessary Coke Consumption for Human Body Incineration, written by a henchman of the plagiarist bloggers, which used to be posted in PDF format online but was then wisely erased. Beyond the farcical, Muhlenkamp's exposition is also false, hypocritical, misleading, and inconsequential. His chapter 8 in the manifesto covers a topic on which, with his usual modesty, he believes himself to be an expert, just as with the topic of mass graves. In order to gauge Muhlenkamp's expertise regarding cremations, it is sufficient to recall his previous principal argument about the calorific value of a human body. And here he's quoting Muhlenkamp, who had written, "I haven't yet found a site quantifying the methane set free during the decomposition of corpses, but we may obtain guideline values from a similar process, the decomposition of animal waste. That is, 5.9 pounds equals so many kilograms of cattle manure produces 30 cubic feet of biogas per day." And Muhlenkamp says, "This is such a huge stupidity that eventually even Muhlenkamp became aware of it, leading him to tacitly eliminate it from his new demonstration, without admitting that his whole argument and all his calculations based on this animal waste argument are completely wrong." Then on page 1458, Matonier writes, "For Sobibor, Muhlenkamp recycles the well-known lie, based obviously only on testimonies about the utilization of the ashes of the cremated as fertilizers for the fields, which is the equivalent of the lie about the human soap." Muhlenkamp had written, "At Sobibor, ashes from the cremated bodies were used as fertilizer for vegetable plots, mixed with sand and spread out across the soil, or taken out of the camp area." This is very common. It's not just this idiot Muhlenkamp that says this, because the whole answer to what did they do with all those ashes from all those cremated bodies that they had, and you know, it's just tons and tons of ash. They say, "Oh well, they were spread around on all the fields, you know, and they acted as fertilizer. They were dumped into the rivers or the lakes. They were just spread out on the ground and so on." But, you know, it's just not, there's no evidence of that. So Carlos says, "The argument is even stupid," the argument that Muhlenkamp is making, "since it would make sense only if the amount of ashes allegedly utilized to fertilize the soil had been so huge as to constitute a considerable amount of the ashes actually produced in Sobibor. For example, some thousands of cubic meters. Muhlenkamp instead adduces testimonies with ridiculous amounts, in his footnotes, say one is Jacob Biscobius, who said, "On order of Wagner, I had to scatter the human ash which was assigned to me from the camp number 3 in the vegetable garden in Sobibor." And Matonier writes, "How much ash could that veggie garden absorb?" And then we have from Court Thomas, again. He said, "According to inmate witness," no, he didn't say this, somebody else, in a letter to the Jewish World Congress, it was written, "According to inmate Court Thomas, ash was loaded into barrels and sent to Germany as fertilizer, or mixed with unburned coal and dirt, and then scattered on the camp's roads." Loaded into barrels and sent to Germany. This quotation, says Matonio, constitutes another proof of Muhlenkamp's hypocrisy and of his opportunistic and deceitful method, which consists of taking single elements of contradictory testimonies and using them to compose a historical reconstruction, which is mere fiction. I quote the passage in its context. So this is the entire passage by this Court Thomas. "When the burning shaft could no longer cope with the huge amounts of the killed people from the gas chambers, on some days 10,000 were killed, The SS in Camp 3 utilized a big mechanical excavator, which dug deep trenches in which the corpses were stacked until the time came when the dead victims could be burned. Then the trenches were opened and the claws of the crane pulled the corpses out and into the shaft. Firebombs, coal, and wood were used in order to accelerate the burning. The ash of the burned, the good white ash, was loaded in barrels and sent to Germany as fertilizer. That's what he said. The ash mixed with unburned coal and the dirt from the shaft was used to sprinkle the roads in the camp due to the sabulosity of the soil. End of quote. Matonio says, this testimony contradicts all the basic elements of the thesis of Muhlenkamp. The cremation was performed within a single facility called burning shaft or cremation shaft, which was evidently different from a simple burning pit and which rather reminds of the Feist apparatus, whatever that is. And then he says, for the cremation, furthermore, neither gasoline nor other liquid combustibles were utilized, but firebombs, he puts an exclamation mark after that, coal and wood. And I thought that using firebombs was something new and different. And he continues, I say it continues, he goes on and on with all of this, but I'm stopping there for chapter for this chapter, and actually there are some conclusions, very good conclusions at the end of this chapter, and they're called Conclusions on the Action Reinhardt Camps. This has to be from Carlo Matonio. It's on page 1468, still a part of this same chapter, which, what did I say it was? Chapter 12. So, of the conclusions, A, he's got them listed with letters. A, documentary evidence. He says there exists no documentary proof for the gassings of Jews in these camps. You know, none. I mean, he means none at all. Not one shred. It's all testimony. B, testimonies. The testimonies are numerous but contradict each other on all fundamental issues, starting with, but not limited to, the killing method. And they are frequently demonstrably false or even nonsensical. C. Material evidence for the killing method. The meticulous archaeological surveys performed at Belzec and Sobibor did not reveal any traces of the alleged gas chambers. And there were some surveys at Treblinka, too. And one of them was by Richard Krieger, who was on the revisionist side, and he didn't find anything. So, but anyway, not even traces of gas chambers were found by these surveys. And there was a lot of them done. And they were done by people who were supposed to be very good at doing it. And there were quite a lot of them, which I've already talked about. But nothing like a gas chamber has ever been discovered. Or the remains of one or anything. D, mass graves. In the case of Belzec and Treblinka, archaeologically ascertained mass graves could not have contained the corpses of those alleged guests. By archaeologically ascertained means that they're not really shown to be mass graves. I guess they weren't dug up or anything, but archaeologically they've said that this was an area that they think contains a mass grave, or, you know, is one of the mass graves. But they've never proved it. But anyway, he is saying, in spite of that, whether they have proved that or not, they're not big enough. You know, they're not able to contain all the corpses that they would have had there. So he writes, in the following table, I list the number of corpses which one cubic meter of grave would have had to contain to make sure that all the claimed corpses would be contained in the total volume of the mass graves discovered. For Belzec, that was 22.3 cubic meters. For Treblinka, it's 58.6 cubic meters. For Belzec, I assume COLA's data, which was the surface area. He's accepting what COLA has said, that there was a gray with a surface area of 5,490 square meters and a volume of 21,000, a little more, cubic meters. Even though, as I demonstrated in point 51 of chapter 11, he doubled the surface area and therefore the real values closer to reality were probably more like 2,750 square meters and 10,750 cubic meters. You see, that's about double what the other numbers. And so from this, Matonio says, it can rightfully be suspected that a similar exterminationist overzealousness can also be expected for Sobibor. This would explain why COLA avoided to publish the same detailed data for this camp, which he had presented for Belzec. Now he goes on to point number E, or letter E, dry wood requirements and ashes produced. He says the cremation of the alleged corpses would have required immense amounts of wood, and for Belzec and Treblinka, this would have produced a volume of ashes, including other incombustibles, bigger than those one of the mass graves. So, yeah, wood requirements and ashes produced. Okay. They needed a huge amount of wood, which is not shown that they could have gotten that wood. He comes up with this next. And also the volume of ashes is way beyond what would even have fit into these graves if they say they have identified. F, fresh wood requirements. And so he was using something else, he said, but then since then he came up with, in his previous book, an example, but he came up with an even better example, and it's this one, and in something called, some German journal called Erinnerungsmeldung number 171 of 20th February 1942, one can read, quote, 25,263 persons are currently employed in the great action of forest work stretching across the whole of Estonia, which was necessary for the supply of burning wood for the cities. The delivery of the wood, for which 9,000 horses are available, has already begun. The daily performance for each forest worker amounts, on average, to about 1.5 solid cubic meter. Matonio writes, the average weight of one solid cubic meter of the prevalent tree types around the extermination camp, which was spruce, pine, birch, is of the so-called extermination camps, is of approximately 9,000 kilograms. Therefore, it can be assumed that the daily production of a tree feller is of 1.35 T. What's the T? For all the three extermination camps, it would have been impossible to obtain within the available time the wood necessary for the cremation as results from the following table. And I don't show the table or give it, but anyway, you know, I mean, just getting the wood, cutting the trees down and finding the wood and delivering it and so on, was the need for it, for all these, to cremate all these people, was huge. And look at all the, and they need so many people doing it in order to get it done, and they didn't have anything like that, and nothing like that going on there. Then G is duration of the cremations. This is the last one of this particular list. Matonio writes, in the three camps of the Action Reinhardt, it would have been impossible to cremate the corpses within the chronological limits resulting from the Orthodox Holocaust historiography. The cremation would have been prolonged well beyond these limits, from a minimum of 3.5 to a maximum of 12 months, as it is displayed in the following table. In other words, in the time that this was going on in these camps, according to the Holocaust historiography, the length of time that it was going on, they could not possibly have cremated so many people in the facilities that they had and the people that they had there and so on. So they would have needed to prolong from 3.5 months up to a maximum of 12 months. In at least one camp, they would have needed one whole year more to get this done. And so now on page 1472, there's a summary. And it's called the Holocaust Summary. Or I guess it is. That's what I've got here. And I've got some items here. Number one, no document exists about the gassing of Jews in the camps of the Action Reinhardt. Some of this gets a little repetitive, but it's okay because it's important. So no document. There's not a single document that refers to gassing Jews in these camps. And number two, the Polish archaeological surveys performed at Belzec and Sobibor found no traces of the gas chambers. We've covered that before, but they've done all these archaeological surveys at Belzec and Sobibor, and I think there was a little bit at Treblinka. This search, Sturdy Coles, this Dr. Caroline Sturdy Coles is the one who's now at Treblinka trying to do her work. She's been there a few times, done a bunch of stuff, but she has to stop because she's got other things to do. But, you know, she hasn't found anything yet, but she says she's going to. It's really funny. Because, you know, she won't. She won't. And then they'll say, they'll use this burial law, as I've already brought out, we think they're here, you know, they're all here, but, or something's here, but we can't disturb. I suppose even if it's ash, they can't, that's still the bones, the bodies of these, the cremated bodies of these Jews. And they still need to be able to rest in peace. And you cannot, they have this weird law. I don't know if they really believe in it or not, that you can't disturb the body of a Jew because you know, he's in the holy light or something like that. They're the light of the world, you know, and they have to be treated that way. You can't go messing around with their grave sites. But when it's necessary, they do it, and they do it all the time. And I think I said that you get the permission from a rabbi, an important rabbi, who gives it, and then you can do it. Anyway, number three, at Belzec and Treblinka, it would have been impossible to bury the corpses of the alleged victims. 281,200 and 654,800 of them, respectively, would have remained unburied. The killing and the burial of at least 434,508 persons in the former and of at least 760,000, almost 500, in the latter camp, which is the Treblinka, the biggest one, can therefore not be real. You see, they would have had, they had 281 more people killed in Belzec than they had a place to bury them. And they had 654, almost 655,000 too many in Treblinka than they had a room to bury them, place to bury them, or time even. Okay, four. From these two camps, the volume of the ashes would have surpassed the respective volume of the mass graves by 31% and 266%. 31% at Belzec and 266% at Treblinka. While in Sobibor, it would have occupied more than 70% of the volume of the graves that have been supposedly found there. Data which do not find archaeological confirmation can therefore not be real. Did I read that in the previous one? He says that, I may have skipped that. He said in number three, the killing and the burial of at least this many people and that many people can therefore not be real. He uses that phrase over and over. Now, in number five, he says, in neither of the three camps, it would have been possible during the claimed time frames to obtain the amount of fresh wood for the cremation of the corpses. In order to supply all three camps with the wood required, the detainees claim to have been charged with this task. The detainees who said they were charged with this task and are said to have been charged with it would have needed 9,716 days to do it, more than 26 and a half years. The supply of such an amount of wood can therefore not be real. And number six, furthermore, the cremation of the alleged corpses would have been impossible without the claimed chronological limits and would have lasted another 592 days. So they needed, getting close to 2 years. Well, it's over a year. I don't know, year and a half. They needed that much more time to cremate all these corpses that they supposedly had there than the time that they had. So he says the cremation of the alleged gassing victims can therefore not be real. But then again, what exactly is real about this exterminationist tale? And that's the end of chapter 12. Well, I'm going to go on. There's after the so-called conclusions, there is I forget what it's called, but there's something kind of a final statements written by the first one by Metonio and the second one by Groff, and they're pretty interesting. And so this I'm going to first read parts of Metonio's, and then I'm going to read all of Groff's if I have time, because it's only a couple pages long. And Metonio says, playing the anti-Semitic card. Well, here they're kind of addressing personal issues that they didn't quite get into. Well, I don't know if they're personal. They seem kind of personal. They didn't quite get into the main part of the book, but they wanted to say something, and Metonio says the most. And this mostly is about anti-Semitism, charges of anti-Semitism, which is why I think it's interesting. And so this starts on page 1488, and this is item 6 already from Metonio. And he writes, as all those who are uninformed, the plagiarist bloggers consider any expression on Jews and Judaism as anti-Semitic, a false term, the proper being anti-Judaic, which is not pompous praise. In their eyes, every critique, no matter how well-founded and justified, becomes an expression of anti-Semitism. They try to include me in their miserable game by writing, and this is something they put in their paper, their 500-page paper against the revisionists. I don't know exactly who wrote this. Maybe it's under all of them. Metonio is much more guarded, meaning than Groff, in his statements, but in 2010, he wrote an article on the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, which stated that the aspiration to world domination by the Jews is already expressed explicitly in rabbinical texts and constitutes the very essence of Jewish messianism. Unquote. Metonio cites approvingly the claims by Bernard Lazare and his own brother, Metonio's brother, that Jews have, throughout history and across all societies in which they have settled, brought persecution upon themselves through their own behaviors. His brother, Metonio's brother, has also given an interview in which he has stated that, from the Talmud, the Midrash, and other rabbinical texts of the tradition, we learn that the murder of non-Jew is not only permitted, but also required, and that this murder could take the form of an actual ritual sacrifice offered to Yahweh. It is a subject that deserves to be investigated, starting from the concept of cherem, anathema, which means anathema, I guess, the extermination of votive enemies of Israel, the annihilation of the Jewish goyim, consecrated to God, This was all a quote by something written by Matonio's brother. And this is on page 523 of their 540-page paper that they call. They don't call it a book. It's never going to be a book, I guess. It's online, though. So Matonio writes, "Fortunately, the reality is a little more complex than what these four imbeciles believe. Besides the anti-Semites, in quotes, and their diametric opponents, the philo-Semites, in quotes, the former not less obtuse than the latter, there exist also mere critics of Judaism. My brother Gianpio, who was unexpectedly implicated by them, is among these critics, and so am I. He is the author of various articles, essays, and studies about the Jewish question. Among them," and then he lists them, they all have Italian titles, but in he puts an English version, and they are Anti-Judaism in Classic Ancient Times, Jewish Imperialism in the Sources of the Rabbinic Tradition. This is by his brother. The Non-Jew in the Shulhan Aruch. Okay, and so Matonio says, "In an attempt to discredit my brother, the plagiarist bloggers quote two sentences of an interview without the least knowing any of his publications, thus demonstrating only their silly philo-Semitic prejudices. It is also clear that they don't even know the Bible. In the books of Numbers, Deuteronomy, Joshua, Samuel, and Isaiah, cherem denotes a person who has to be killed, or a thing which that has, it's not such good English always, or a thing that has to be destroyed based on the command of God." And give some stuff there. "And more diplomatically, a thing devoted to God without hope for redemption. In parentheses, if animated to be killed." Or, Matonio says, a little more explicitly, a real and proper Yahweh Befel. I think that was kind of cute because, you know, we talk about the Fuhrer Befel, which is to say the order to exterminate all the Jews. Well, Matonio is saying that this order from the God in the Jewish literature and I guess in the Old Testament is a real and proper Yahweh Befel. He then says, an Italian writer troubled himself to count the number of persons exterminated according to the Bible by virtue of the cherem, and it came up to 2,120,182. Well, it didn't quite get to 6 million, but it's as many as they actually are able to really claim. The biblical Yehudim were therefore real forerunners of the Einsatzgruppen. He writes, actually even worse, because besides men, women, and children, they even exterminated the animals. Is pointing this out anti-Semitic too? Well, that's the part that I have quoted from Carlo Matonio's last chapter there. And so now I'm going to go to the PDF and read what Jürgen Graf said at the end. And he calls his, it's 13.2 chapter, The Bogeyman of Anti-Semitism. He writes on pages 521, our opponents make a pathetic attempt to analyze the alleged motives which have prompted Matonio, Hughes, and me to become revisionists. They wrote, simply refuting their work misses a crucial part of a proper analysis of MGK, namely the driving force behind MGK's fraudulent work. Graf writes, predictably, Holocaust controversies, meaning that group of people in their blog site, comes to the conclusion that our driving force is anti-Semitism. As a matter of fact, since the days of Paul Rassinier, the opponents of revisionism have regularly tried to mask their intellectual impotence by accusing the revisionists of anti-Semitism, Nazism, and racism. This chimera was developed to perfection by Deborah Lipstadt in her book, Denying the Holocaust. It goes without saying that we are not obliged to comment on our adversary's analysis, which is a mere inadmissible ad hominem attack, because the motives of a researcher are irrelevant. Only the results count. In my book, The Giant with Feet of Clay, I did not attack Raul Hilberg for being a Zionist Jew. I criticized him for using a flawed method, which unavoidably leads to faulty results. Likewise, any attempt to refute a revisionist book by attacking the real or alleged political beliefs of its author is untenable and impermissible from a scientific point of view. Even if all revisionists were staunch admirers of Adolf Hitler, this would not necessarily mean that their conclusions are wrong, just as the fact that most Holocaust historians are Jews does not prove that their theses are unfounded. For these reasons, Thomas Cuse has decided not to waste his precious time by responding to the accusation of anti-Semitism. However, Carlo Mantogno and I have decided to briefly comment on some of the attacks directed against us, not because we feel obliged to defend our convictions against intellectual midgets, but in order to demonstrate once again that our critics are both frauds and ignoramuses. So he says on page 522, Holocaust Controversy states, he, Graf, joined the Pro-Stalinist Institute of Russian Civilization, a group that spreads anti-Semitic positions, such as through reprinting and defending the authenticity of the protocols of the Elders of Zion, and accusing Jews of using Christian blood in their rituals. Graf responds, it is quite true that I cooperate with the Institute of Russian Civilization, an Orthodox and nationalist think tank, that this institute should be pro-Stalinist. He puts in parentheses that this institute should be considered pro-Stalinist is a puerile invention, and that I am on friendly terms with its director, Dr. Oleg Platonov. Platonov believes in the authenticity of the protocols of the Elders of Zion, whereas I think that these protocols are a very clever and elaborate forgery which was not fabricated by the Tsar's secret police, as conventional wisdom has it, but by entirely different people. He doesn't say who. That is why I never even mentioned this text in any of my books or articles. In other words, while Platonov and I agree on many things, we disagree on others, such as the authenticity of the protocols of the Elders of Zion. This does not prevent Holocaust controversies from mendaciously speaking of Graf's defense and association with the protocols of the Elders of Zion, quote unquote. And that, I believe, is the end of... Yeah, there's an epilogue written by Jürgen Graf, but I'm not going to do that. So, now, I have some main points. And you know, I said in my mailer today, for today's show, tonight's show, that we're going to sum up and that, you know, point out that the final blow has been struck against the Holocaust myth with this book of these three gentlemen. And you might, so I'm sure there are people who are saying, well, what is the final blow? Let's see it. Well, I'm going to try to, describe how I see that. And first I'm going to go through these main points this is written by me, and this was from the parts that I have read. I haven't even read the whole thing. Couldn't possibly do it, but the parts that I've read and what I've talked about on my programs that I've decided to use are some things that were impressive to me. And one of them was that these revisionists showed with actual train schedules, this was in Thomas Kew's parts, that Jews were transported east, and in they were on all, a lot of these trains were came from different ghettos and concentration camps, and they went right past these Reinhardt camps. They went close by these Reinhardt camps, but they didn't go to these Reinhardt camps. So they weren't all going there. And they were, well, he showed that they, a lot of them went into the east. There's no way to, there's not proof that every Jew that they want to talk about, every number that's described, you know, where they went and where they ended up, but that they were going there and that a lot of them were there, a lot of them ended up there, is true. And that they weren't, that this huge number, even though it was on these reports that they were to go there, they didn't necessarily, or if they did, they were just, they went through the cleaning up process and then went on their way. There's a good map that Thomas Kutis had, which I couldn't find again, which showed how if the Jews were let off, say at, I think this was at Sobibor, they were let off, you know, at the train platform there, and then there were some little buildings there, they supposedly were processed, and then they walked to this, up the, this path that was supposed to go to the undressing room. And so it shows where this supposed undressing room was. And then from the undressing room, they walked further up the path and even partly through the woods to the gas chamber, where the gas chamber was supposed to be. And then it shows that there's a way that they went around from the gas chamber, which wasn't a gas chamber, but was a shower and a cleanup place, actually. And they went from there to... with new clothes and so on, and they went out and they went around the back and back to the, in a kind of a semicircle, and back to the train platform. But that was a possibility, you know, that was a scenario that could have taken place, he was pointing out there. But anyway, this was one thing that was new to me. And then point B, the revisionists, in my estimation, proved that this transporting of Jews was the final solution, as there was no plan to bring them back. There are reports and so on showing that the Jews were to be transported as far into the east, and that this was going on, and there were all these, they were in these trains, and the trains were moving and so on, that this was happening. And this was the so-called solution to the Jewish problem in the German-occupied areas. And they weren't going to come back, but then in the end, some of them did because of the changing fortunes of the war, and they had to bring all their prisoners back with them. But a lot of those that went on into the Soviet Union, you know, then was no longer the Soviet Union, was no longer German-occupied, they didn't. There was just some in these camps that were moved back, like Auschwitz and so on. I really, at the moment, unless I would refresh myself on all that, I can't speak with exactitude about it. But all these ones that really went far east, they were not brought back. And they showed, Thomas Kew showed, and I thought this was very impressive, that Stalin did round up these foreign Jews after the war, and he sent them to gulags in Siberia. And this is shown by these newspaper articles and these reports by Jewish organizations and so on. Quite a number of them that people were saying they're coming and they're taking the Jews and they're taking them away and putting them on trains and so on. And these Jews were not seen again in these areas, and they weren't taking the Russian Jews who had always been there, but they were taking the Jews that had been brought in. And you know, Stalin didn't want to keep them after 45, because I would say I would say, because they weren't Russian. And he was so distrustful of everybody and everything. And they also were very Zionistic, and he didn't like that. And he didn't want to let all these Jews leave, and he didn't want to keep them there. And instead, he put them in these gulags, from which they probably didn't survive for the most part. So that is another very real possibility that has I've never seen, you know, brought out, and it makes a lot of sense if you ask me. So that's another thing where they're showing, you know, because there's always this question: where did they go? You know, where did all those Jews go? Well, there still were a lot of Jews left. You know, the Jewish population was not decimated. But if a lot of them were lost, this was an answer to what happened to them. Then D, they proved that no gas chambers existed in these camps. I think, you know, this has been done before, but I think they did, as they even said, an even better job of covering everything. If you, you know, there's so much in this book, and just like every, here's the way it worked. These five bloggers brought up every objection to what these three men had written about in their previous books. Hughes was just a part of the Sobibor book, but, you know, mostly Matonio and Groff in their books about Belzec and Treblinka, and then Majdanek and even Kelmno. And all of that, they brought up all kinds of objections. And they answered every one of them, and then some. So there's every kind of thing that Holocaust historians come up with seems to have been answered by their book. And they went into an incredible amount of detail, particularly Matonio and Q's are into that kind of thing. So I think it's been proven without a doubt. And then what else proved it was these archaeological investigations and surveys that have been done by the Holocaust teams. And they have had about six or so in these camps, and they've never found anything. They pretend like they're finding stuff. Oh, we found some bones. We found some human remains. Yeah, well, people were buried. But not in the numbers or not anything like what they need to. And they talk about they find these foundations or there were some buildings. And that's all, they don't agree on that either. And you can't say what these buildings were. And mostly they were not adequate to do what they say they had to be. Nothing like gas chambers there at any of them. So they're pretty much, you know, it's been proven. They just won't admit it. It's been proven. And it's been proven also, the Holocausters have proven that there's none there because they can't find them. And they can't show that. And it's, how long has this been now? We're talking about 70 years after the fact, and nothing is there except a bunch of monuments and paved over areas and those big stones all over Treblinka and so on, these crazy things that they do. It's just, anybody with any intelligence can see right through it. Anyway, my number E here, they also proved, I think, that the numbers of the dead were and are wildly inflated. Matonio does a very good job of that. He does all that mathematics and so on and figuring out how many bodies can go here and what they say, and he goes by what they claim and shows that it's not possible. Everything that they're saying that they could have killed that number of people there and cremated them and, you know, disappeared them that way, it's just not possible. And he's pointed that out in several different kind of ways, by grave size, by cremation time, by the fuel available, by the ability to collect all that fuel and so on. So there's no accounting for these things. They don't have any answers for these things that Holocausters don't. Now, F, they've also proved that, and by using so many examples, that the witnesses lied, and even they're very contradictory. When you're that contradictory, inconsistent in your testimony, it can't be taken seriously. It just can't be. And when what you say has so many improbabilities in it, it just puts a cloud over you as a reliable witness. And then the so-called perpetrators, you know, the Germans who were there in charge of the camps, and their confessions are also, you know, gone over very carefully and shown how they don't fit reality either, and they should be, you know, highly questionable. So what we have is a whole scenario here called Action Reinhardt camps and extermination camps, which has no backing in anything forensic or in anything documentary, and is only based on what people have said about it. And even that doesn't hold up when you look things over more carefully. So no forensic evidence, no documentary evidence, no evidence of an extermination of Jews, period. There's nothing there. And as we kind of talked about, they use the burial law to stop any digging of grave sites that they don't really want to dig up, because they know they won't find anything, but they want to pretend that stuff is there. And when they think that they will actually find something, they do dig it up. So it's all very dishonest. And so I think that now here's what I say is the finishing blow, that we've already gone through Auschwitz, and Auschwitz has been dealt with. You know, they brought the number from 4 million down to 1.1 million, and some say much less than that, of dead. And then they moved it over to Action Reinhardt camps, where supposedly a couple of million, or almost a couple of million, Jews were exterminated there. And what they've done here is that, you know, totally demolished that. They had already demolished it, but they demolished it even better now. And so that you can't say, well, it didn't so much happen at Auschwitz now. It happened at Belzec, Treblinka, and Sobibor. It didn't happen there either. So what are they left with? What they're left with is their control. They have control of the media. They have control of all these governments. And think about this pathetic story that they have dreamed up, and how awful it is. And then think of how all these governments, heads of governments and representatives in the government of all these European nations go along with what the Jews want them to say and do. Because they're basically, because it's just a political thing. It's to keep the current regime of political control of those who are in power, the left-wing parties and so on, to keep them in the ascendancy, and to keep anything right-wing from gaining any strength. And they use this. They use this Holocaust. And that's the reason that they all go along with it. And then we have the UN, which is, it's really pathetic. That story I read in the beginning, how the UN is not just goes along with this, but is part of the whole thing right from the beginning, and is keeping it. If anything happens, it comes up with something, you know. So now that they're worried about the deniers growing, they're trying to come up with whatever they can, and to keep this myth going. So. But the myth is dead. I mean, the myth has been destroyed. There's nothing left to it. It can't really survive. It could never survive on its own. It's like on life support, being kept alive by the power structure. And so, as I have often argued in the past, we need to attack the power structure because otherwise, as much as I respect and love these revisionists and what they're doing and want to support them and so on, and I know how important it is what they've done, still, it's not quite enough. I'm not hearing. I get a 60-minute cue come up, but I'm not hearing it for some reason. Let me go back to my SkyCon. So, ladies and gentlemen, this is the end of my series on trying to communicate about this wonderful book that these men have written. And I hope that you have gotten something out of it and that it's done some good. Well, now I heard the... Oh, I know why. I forgot to put in my... I unplugged... Huh, very funny of me. I unplugged my earphones. Now I'm plugging them in. It's a little bit late now. I guess I won't bother. So I'm barely hearing it, but I heard 30. So that's it for tonight. Thank you very much, and do keep trying to promote this revisionist work. Good night.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit Carolyn's website at carolynyager.com.